There's a wall at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School that students passed every day. On it, there's an inscription, a famous Gandhi quotation, "Be the change you wish to see in the world." Today, almost a week after 17 people were shot to death at the school, students are doing just that. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. 100 Stoneman Douglas students are heading up to Tallahassee to meet with officials about legislation to prevent future school shootings. We'll hear more about that, and we'll talk to a Republican state senator who has some ideas of his own about how to make Florida schools safer. Also, the father of the family that took in the alleged shooter speaks out. And Young Arts Miami, previous winners are in town to mentor the next generation. All of that coming up today on Sundial. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, thousands of people are attending funerals this week for the 17 Douglas High School victims. WLRN's Katie Swatowski has attended a number of them, and right now she's with a group of students from Douglas. They're about to get on buses and head off to Tallahassee. They're bringing their concerns about gun laws to the governor, cabinet members, and to legislators. And she was actually at a funeral not too long ago. Katie Swatowski joining us now. Katie, welcome to the program.
Hi, Luis. Thanks for having me.
You were at a funeral just recently. What was it, today?
It was this morning. 17-year-old Carmen Shentrup was honored in Coral Springs at an Episcopal church.
And how many people were in attendance, roughly?
Hundreds. I would guess over 1,000. The church was absolutely packed.
How many of these have you attended so far?
This is my third.
And when you talk about these funerals, you know, you have all of these people in attendance. It's friends, classmates, family, and so forth. But has there been anything that stood out to you about these funerals? Obviously, because we have so many victims of this shooting. But I don't know. Tell me a little bit about some of the things that you've seen and experienced.
Attendance has not wavered at them. You know, the funerals that I attended on Sunday and Monday were, you know, just as full as the one this morning. And what's interesting to me is it's not just family and friends and classmates that are attending. It is people that didn't even know these students that are just from the community and want to show solidarity that are hurt by this too.
Tell me about some of the people you've met over the last few days.
You know, friends of parents, students, in the community members, you know, I've had people tell me that they can't put their finger on why these students that were the victims in this tragedy were the victims, but they were incredible people. This morning, Carmen Shentrup, she wanted to be a doctor. She had just been accepted to the University of Florida days before the shooting and was planning to attend and try to go into the medical profession. And all of her classmates that talked to me said, you know, she was going to accomplish something great. I mean, she was a doer. And I have students here where we're in the parking lot of this Publix right across from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. And they're getting ready to board two huge coach buses and go to Tallahassee to talk to lawmakers tomorrow. And I asked some of the students, you know, what has pushed you to come do this today? And the answer was, you know, my friend, who whichever victim they're doing this for, was a very vocal, outspoken person who loved to advocate. And if they were alive, they would be here doing this. So that's why I'm here for them.
And my understanding is roughly 100 students, correct, that are making this trip?
Yes, in this trip.
Who's leading that? Who's putting that together?
Leading this group. And right now they're sitting on a huge box organizing the students into bus groups, or we'd be talking to them. But it's two students that put this together overnight. They worked with Senator Lauren Book to get this. They were going to sleep on the floor in the Florida Capitol, and they worked it out so that they could instead have cots donated by the Red Cross in the Civic Center, just a few blocks away.
Do they have any conversations with, say, the governor, the cabinet, any lawmaker? Do they have any of these conversations already scheduled, or do they plan to just show up and see who will actually talk to them?
No, things are scheduled. They're set to break up into small groups tomorrow morning at 8:45, and they are truly in meetings until 6 p.m. And that's certain students will meet with certain lawmakers. They're branching off into smaller groups, but Senator Lauren Book helped make these appointments with lawmakers, and they want, you know, they know and acknowledge that a bill cannot be written overnight that will solve this tragedy, and they've all told me this, but they want progress. They want to start to something. They want to see something happen by the time that they leave.
Again, Katie Switalski, WLRN reporter. She is out in, she's in Broward County. Again, 100 students, roughly 100 students from Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School are getting up on buses soon. They're going to be going up to Tallahassee. They have meetings scheduled with lawmakers and hopefully maybe the governor, talking about bringing up the issue of gun laws and what the state could do. Lawmakers only have a few weeks left in this legislative session, but will they be able to get lawmakers to do anything in this session in dealing with the issue of guns or gun laws here in the state? Now, a little later on in this program, we're going to hear from Republican State Senator Rene Garcia. He's got some ideas on the issue of gun laws and also how to make schools safer. We're going to take a quick break, come back, and we're going to talk with WLRN's Tim Padgett, who has been working on the story of the couple who actually took the shooter under their care. We're going to find out what they knew or didn't know. That's all coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, two more people getting a lot of attention following the shooting of the students and staff at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School are James and Kimberly Sneed. This is the couple who took in the alleged shooter, Nicholas Cruz, when he had nowhere else to go after his mother died. They were helping him get his GED. They had just gotten him into therapy for depression. And in a much more controversial decision, they allowed Cruz to keep his AR-15, the gun that he is alleged to have used in the shooting. We're joined now by WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, who's been following this story. All right, Tim, so, I mean, we heard, you know, some of that conversation that you had. We're going to hear a couple of clips here from James Sneed. But, I mean, your overall impression, who are these two people?
They're very typical Parkland affluent suburban
family. James Sneed is a construction consultant. His wife Kimberly is a nurse. They have three boys, all of whom attended Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. One is still attending there.
And he was a friend of
that was the
Nicholas.
Youngest son, and he was the one who is a friend of Nicholas Cruz. Befriended him in junior ROTC there, the program there at Douglas High. And when Nicholas Cruz's mother passed away in November, he was essentially left without parents. His father died 12 years ago. And this family, through the friendship with the younger son, took him in. And by all accounts, it was a very admirable gesture on their part.
What did they know about this? And look, we're still learning who this
sure.
kid is and
sure.
a lot of his background. More reports came out yesterday. Mm-hmm. But what did they know about him?
Not much, according to the father, only what they knew through the son and his friendship with Cruz. What they did know, what they came to learn as he moved in, was that he was, as James Sneed says, very depressed, particularly because of his mother's death in just a few months before. And that was the only mental health issue they claim they really knew or understood about him. They say they were not aware of all this other much darker social media history that that he'd left a footprint on the internet in terms of Instagram photos of him waving guns and knives and things of that nature.
Now, but he does show up and he has these weapons and he has the AR-15. And they said, "What about that?"
Well, they are, at least James Sneed, the father I talked to, he made it very clear that he's very pro gun ownership rights, and his feeling was that as long as the gun was legal, it was legally purchased, the AR-15 rifle, and that Nicholas Cruz was a 19-year-old adult, he felt that it was okay for Nicholas Cruz to bring that assault rifle into the home as long as, and this was a stipulation, as long as it was locked away in a gun safe locker, to which James Sneed thought he was the only one who had the key.
All right. Let's listen to, one of these clips that you had from James Sneed as he talked about not only the gun, but he's also talked about what he did know about Nicholas Cruz.
What everybody seems to know is what we didn't know. He was nothing but respectful. His mother passed away, so we knew he was very depressed. He was lonely. He was wearing the weight of the world on his shoulders. My wife had actually taken him Friday a week ago to see a therapist where he talked to the therapist briefly, and ironically, he was supposed to see a therapist this week.
So he did take him to a therapist, but he did not know all of these other things. And yesterday we had also reported that in a report that what else we now know about Mr. Cruz is that he also had issues with ADHD, depression, and he's on the spectrum.
Right.
Autistic.
Well, and he'd also been, he'd encountered agents from the Department of Children and Family Services in Florida on more than one occasion in recent years. All of this, however, the family claims that they were not aware of it. And all that they were aware of was that he did have depression issues and that they also knew that he had been expelled from Douglas High last year because of fighting or other issues for disciplinary reasons. And They simply felt that, even though he had this depression problem, they still felt that it was okay for him to own the AR-15 and bring it into their home. So that's the real tragic contradiction of, on the one hand, you have a family that is being, very admirably charitable to a young man who obviously had a lot of problems, not just the death of his mother. I think they were also aware that, he had probably been bullied a bit in school, and that he was a bully himself. But they felt that they thought that he was, they could help him. But then on the other hand, for all the kindness they showed him, they are coming under a lot of public scrutiny for this decision to let a depressed 19-year-old male bring an assault rifle into their home. And they're not under legal liability because it was legal, but they are definitely under public scrutiny.
Now, I mean, you had the opportunity to, you met the couple.
No, I did not. I spoke with them by phone. They had to go up to New York over the weekend. I spoke to them by phone
yesterday.
And they
have an attorney now.
They have an attorney, Jim Lee, because obviously when something of this magnitude happens, you do want some legal protection because of the focus that's falling on you.
Talking to them by phone, I mean, what sense did you get about, where they are right now? As he said, we heard in the cut that everybody seems to know what we didn't know. But what did you pick up on when you talked to them?
A lot of angst, obviously. I mean, a lot of anguish in terms of just second guessing every decision they made. James Sneed insists that he still feels that it was the correct decision to let the young man have that weapon in the home. But obviously, you can imagine the turmoil they're going through right now in terms of second guessing even a decision that they thought was correct.
All right. Let's listen to that other cut that we have from Mr. James Sneed.
It's legal. If you want an assault rifle, you get an assault rifle. If they change it, I'll think differently. I'm not afraid of guns. I have a tremendous amount of respect for them. Do I think there needs to be a better background check system? Absolutely. Part of the stipulation for him moving in, they'd have to get some kind of gun safe. And he did.
Does he still feel the same way? I mean, after the fact, does he still believe that? I mean, you just said it, that he felt that he was right, but he still have the same beliefs and ideas? He would do this the same way?
Yes, no, as I mentioned, I mean, Mr. Sneed is very very much in support of gun ownership rights. He feels that assault rifles as well should be legally obtainable in the United States. And I think, in a way, this is very important because I think, we've been so involved in recent days watching these students and the Never Again movement and their caravan to Tallahassee. And I think we've been given this impression that in the wake of this shooting, all of the Parkland community up there is suddenly pro-gun control and pounding on politicians' doors to get more gun control. I think Mr. Sneed is a reminder to us, an important reminder, that much of that community up there is pro-gun, like him, and that not all of the community is, you know, part of this student wave. And I think, you know, if you dig down, if you get under the surface of that community, you're going to see a lot more of Mr. Sneed's attitudes as well as the students.
Something else that jumps out at me is the fact that, look, every time one of these things happens, so the parents all of a sudden are under the microscope.
Right.
Granted, this wasn't, he's not the parent of this child. And
no.
He was only taking care of him. How long was Nicholas Cruz in his house?
He was only a matter of more than a month or
a
so.
Month.
Right, exactly. I mean, and here's the other point, you know, that they will make is that, you know, when it comes to the social media history, for example, he was a 19-year-old adult. He was not their son. They didn't feel any real compulsion to have to, you know, go into his room and open his computer and,
right.
and look into his internet behavior.
Well, even talking yesterday to teachers, I asked them, I said, how many parents do you know are tracking their kids on social media all
right.
the time?
Mm-hmm.
Not a lot.
Right.
And this is not his kid. Is their son going to talk, or are they keeping him sheltered away from?
No, they're shielding the son. Understandably, they're shielding the son. They would not reveal his name or talk about him.
But they're not facing any kind of legal, you know.
Not that I've seen. Again, they do have a lawyer, and that's understandable. But when you consider the fact that, you know, by an adult of Nicholas Cruz's age buying an AR-15 is, you know, legal, legally it doesn't look like they, you know, have any issues. As I said, it's not the legal liability issue that they're staring at; it's the public scrutiny.
At some point, issue, though, right? At some point, you will probably see lawsuits flying around. For a lot of things, I mean, do you think that
would not surprise me? I think they probably are vulnerable to perhaps civil actions, particularly on the part of the families of the victims. I don't know if those would get traction, but again, that's a reason why they do have a lawyer, as Jim Lewis, a Fort Lauderdale attorney, who's representing them.
At this point, you know, one of the things that I remember reading is that with the public defender's office, that they're seeking to that they will plead guilty if the death penalty is taken off the table.
Right.
But really at this point in these kind of stories and cases, it seems like the story of this kid will just kind of come out slowly over time.
Right.
You know, everything that we know now, I mean, what else do we need to know?
Well, Department of Family and Children and Family Services, DCF, is apparently this week going to be releasing new documents about its engagements with Nicholas Cruz and with his mother, died in November, but had also been having a real hard time with him. He was emotionally disturbed, and he had very erratic behavioral problems, some of which forced her often, and not on more than one occasion, to call the police in to try to, you know, get him under control.
I think back to the Sandy Hook shooter, and it wasn't that a case we had another kid on the spectrum also,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, how does that play in this?
I don't think that it really does. I mean, autism, I think we have to, you know, is not that's a communication issue. It's a social communication issue. It's not a mental health issue, really. So I don't think, you know, again, I don't think the autism either is or should be a factor that they're going to be looking into a lot. I think it has more to do with genuine mental health issues that he was also dealing with, and that his mother apparently could not deal with adequately, and a lot of neighbors and other people in the community in Parkland. I mean, I've talked to, you know, more than a few kids up there who knew him and just saw this to be very apparent to them on a daily basis.
We will obviously learn more and more about Nicholas Cruz as time passes. Again, WLRN's America's editor, Tim Padgett, joining me. Appreciate it, Tim.
Thank you.
And just to mention, too, this a report, looking on a phone here, a report from CBS News. Not too long ago, students from Florida's West Boca High School walked out of their classes, and they were heading towards Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School as part of a call to action by students in the area after the mass shooting that took the lives of 17 people. Again, 100 students from Marjory Stoneman Douglas High heading up to Tallahassee today to meet with lawmakers. Coming up, we're going to hear from one of those lawmakers, Republican State Senator Rene Garcia from Hialeah. He's going to share some of his thoughts on how to keep schools safer. That's coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I want to turn now to a conversation that I had yesterday. This is a pre-recorded conversation with Republican State Senator Rene Garcia. His district is in Hialeah. And we talked a little bit about his ideas of trying to make school campuses safer. You know, Senator, in the wake of the Parkland shooting, you want the Florida Senate to put together a task force to help keep schools safe. What should it consider?
Look, there's a lot of things that it needs to consider, and I don't pretend to have the answers. I never pretend to have any the answers because it's a very complicated issue. But just because it's a complicated issue doesn't mean that we can't address it. And you know, this task force that I'm asking for, it's not a task force that I want to see drag out for infinity. It's something that I want us to sit down and have a conversation, take a holistic approach on how we address the issue of violence in our communities. Especially in our school, in light of what happened at Parkland. But the things that I personally think that I should consider are issues as, the sharing of information between our local, state, and federal partners. We need to look at the issue of mental health. And I bring up mental health. I don't bring up mental health so it could be a red herring so people could hide behind it and say, oh, it's just a mental health issue. No, it's not just a mental health issue. It also has to encompass the easy access to some of these militarized style weapons that we have right now. It has to be a holistic and comprehensive approach if we're ever going to deal with the violence that we have in our communities.
Let's go on that mental health aspect, though, real quickly. What kind of help do you think schools need dealing with students' mental health issues?
Look, identifying individuals, identifying students when they're early on, and making sure we get them into treatment. I have worked pretty close with Dade County Public Schools on some of their programs that they have in Broward County as well. But we have to expand those programs at community base. When I mean community base, at the actual school itself. Make sure that we have not only counselors, but we can identify students when they are having a crisis and make sure we get them into treatment. Because if we do that, we can save a lot of money in the long run, and we can save a lot of lives, right? And we have to start having the conversation about mental health, take that conversation seriously. To ensure that not only children, but people have the access that they need and their families have the access that they need for mental health treatment.
You're calling for school guards who are former police officers or members of the military. If you could elaborate on that, but where would the districts find them and how would they pay for them?
I'm not calling for that. I am calling for that to be as part of the consideration that we should have that conversation. And we hear that we should harden our schools, and we hear that our schools are soft targets. And using, ex-police officers and using former military personnel who are trained could be an option. When I was growing up, we had police officers in our schools, especially in high school. And these weren't school resource officers, but, due to budgetary constraints and so forth, they started backing away from that. And now we see that Dade County has their own police force. But I think it's important to ensure that we do harden our schools. And what that hardening of the school will look like would be up to the committee or the task force. I personally don't have the answer for that.
Do you think those guards should be armed? Do you think the schools maybe should consider other protective measures?
No, absolutely. Look, and that's why I say it's important to make sure that that's on the table. And when we hear through our committee process and we hear folks, no, we don't want any guns in the schools. Yeah, we don't want guns in the schools, but we need to make sure that we harden these targets. And how do we harden these targets to protect our children is what we should be asking ourselves. It can't be just, no, we don't want this. We don't want no guns, or we have to make sure we have five teachers in each school that have guns. No, I think it should be somewhere in the middle of that conversation. And again, I don't have the answers, but I'm willing to sit down with everyone to make sure that we come up with a comprehensive approach to take care of our students.
And you talk about hardening the targets. I mean, there's currently an effort in the Senate to allow principals to give staff permission to bring guns to school. What do you think of that idea?
No, I think it shouldn't just be, the principal determining who it is. I think we have to work with law enforcement. We have to work for the men and women who are trained to carry firearms. I think if we were ever to go down a path to harden our schools in that sense, you can't do it without the use of local law enforcement. They have to be part of the equation.
The governor is holding a series of workshops Tuesday on school safety issues. What do you want him and your fellow legislators to consider?
What I want to see done is that we need to stop talking past each other. We need to stop retreating to our corners, because it's easier to retreat to our corners and point the finger at everyone else and say, it's a Republican's fault. It's a Democrat's fault. No, we as a society have failed our children because we have always consistently retreat to our corners and point those fingers. We as Republicans and Democrats and independents have to understand the only way to address this issue is by sitting down and having a conversation, having a dialogue, and understanding that we're going to have to agree to disagree. But we cannot continue to move forward and put our children and our society and our residents at risk by our inaction. So what I wish we would do is take that holistic approach and not just look at the way, that not just say we have to have gun control. What does gun control mean? Complete ban on guns? Complete ban on assault weapons? What does it mean to harden our schools? Is it completely, you know, make sure that we have all military-style people at our schools, or have, you know, have teachers carrying weapons? We have to stay away from those talking points, and that's why it's important for us to bring it together and to make sure that we address the issues that are really at the core of the problem. And it's not just one; it's multiple issues that need to be addressed if we're going to protect our society and protect our children.
Since the shooting, what sort of conversations are lawmakers having in Tallahassee? What are some of the ideas being discussed by you and your peers, you know, in making schools safer and dealing with this problem?
I think the conversations that we're having are a broad spectrum of different topics. You know, I focus a lot of times on mental health. Others are focusing on how to harden our soft targets. We're talking about, you know, the reality of being able to share more information with our local and federal partners. There's different conversations, but what happens far too often is they happen in a silo. And yes, if I may think that mental health is the way to go, but it just can't be about mental health. It has to be a comprehensive approach. It has to be. It can't be an all or nothing scenario when it comes to our friends in both parties, because if we go in with that mentality of all or nothing, if I don't get what I want, you're not going to get what you want, then that means the ones that don't get what they want is our residents, our voters, and our constituents, especially our children. Those are the ones that they need action from us. We are the ones that need to stand up and say, we are here, and we're going to make sure that this doesn't happen again, or at least prevent it from, an issue like this happening again. So that's where we need to be, not only as elected officials, but as a society, and demand action today.
A group of students from Stoneman Douglas High School are heading up to Tallahassee. Do you plan to meet with them?
They haven't reached out. They haven't reached out to us yet, but we definitely will. If they're up here, I definitely will meet with them. As you very well know, I'm not one to ever shy away from the conversation or the dialogue. And it's important to continue to have this conversation. And I only hope and I pray that when the media and the cameras disappear, that we don't stop pushing this issue forward, because the time is now and we need to act. So yes, I absolutely will meet with them and talk with them and encourage them and be here for them.
What sort of influence does the NRA have in Tallahassee? And I wondered your thoughts on, you know, any politician, Democrat or Republican, that has received any money from the NRA. Is it almost politically dangerous to be linked to them at this point?
I don't know if it's politically dangerous to be linked to them at this point or not, but the one special interest that we have that we should be worried about is our students, our children, and our communities. And that's why I say, you know, I understand the NRA's position about protecting the Second Amendment. I understand where they're coming from, but we always have to understand that there is some limitations to all of our rights. And we need to make sure that we protect not only the Second Amendment, but all the amendments that we have in the Constitution to ensure that we protect the freedoms and liberties of the residents that we represent and our constituents back home. So I would say that it's no different than any other interest group that we have up here in Tallahassee or in Washington, D.C. You know, I will sit down and have conversations with them. I have voted with them and I have voted against them in the past. And we as a body, legislative body, I think it's time for us to stand up and say that we're going to do the right thing, regardless of what interest group may be pushing one issue or the other.
Let me do one quick follow-up on that. Some people believe the NRA has too much influence. What's your take on that?
Look, the only influence, if they have too much influence, shame on those members. Because the only ones that should be influencing our decisions up here should be our constituents. That's what we need to be worried about. That's what we need to be fighting for. And legislators that may be beholden to the NRA, I would say, I hope you would doing, if you'll be doing a better job at your districts and representing your people, you wouldn't be beholden to any interest groups. You know, so that's incumbent upon each member to work the districts, be there in the districts, and represent the people that they elected them to do their job up here in Tallahassee.
Again, Senator, thanks so much.
Thank you. And I really do appreciate you bringing this issue to light, and keeping the conversation going is what's paramount. If we are to effectuate change, this is the only way that we're going to do it, is by talking about it and bringing people to the table, and more importantly, not pointing the fingers and coming together as a state, as a society, and as a nation to address these issues.
Again, that is Republican State Senator Rene Garcia. He is of the district from Hialeah, joining us to talk about the issue of keeping schools' campuses safer. All right, we're going to take a step away from this story, get a little respite, and talk about a local institution that's been inspiring young people for decades, Young Arts. That's coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, during a week like this, it could be hard to remember that regular life does go on, but it has to. And one of the most beloved institutions in South Florida has put together a special experience for students in our area. Young Arts Miami is bringing back successful alumni who are creating artworks and performances with local high school students. With me in studio now, two of them, dancer and choreographer Caleb Teicher. Caleb, welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Also joining me, composer, cellist, and pianist Dave Egger. Dave, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
You know what? I'm going to jump back and forth between the two of you. Caleb, let me start with you real quickly. You won in 2011.
Yes.
What was your young arts experience like? How do you describe it to young people?
It was remarkable. I was 17 years old. I was fresh out of high school, and I knew very little about the greater arts world outside of the small nucleus of talented tap dancers. And I went to Miami. I was a winner for the program, and they flew me down, and I was suddenly introduced to a group of 150, I think that was the number at the time, winners of many different disciplines. So I was sitting at lunch and going to master classes and seeing performances by vocalists of all genres, classical, jazz, pop, and theater artists, spoken in musical theater. I was meeting dancers of different disciplines, classical Indian dancers, ballet dancers, contemporary dancers. And the week was really remarkable because it was kind of my first exposure to this greater world of exceptionally talented, passionate, driven young artists.
Having that experience, did it do anything in your career choices, or were you already on a path? You knew what you were going to do.
I think Young Arts does a really remarkable job of catching young artists at a pivotal point. You know, this is when you are transitioning maybe from high school to college, or maybe from high school to some other kind of conservatory, or maybe just going out into the real world, as they call it, and trying to make something. And it's a moment where it's a great crisis. You know, am I good enough? Is this what I should be doing? Do I have enough passion and inspiration within myself to make this a life, a career? And Young Arts caught me at that time where I was questioning for the first time whether or not this is something I was going to take out of my high school pursuits. and it was completely life-changing. I say frequently it's the best thing I did with my life.
Dave, you
yes,
you won, well, a little longer ago.
A little longer ago.
1987,
that was a while,
right?
Yeah.
All right. What was it like then? You know, was there Young Arts Week when winners gathered?
There was. It was here in Miami, and some of it was at the university, actually. I had a very similar experience to Caleb in that I grew up in a classical music family, and I was competitive classical musician, so I kind of only saw that. And when I came to Young Arts Week, suddenly I was experiencing dancers and visual artists. And even though I was a cellist, I was always an improvising cellist, and that made me an oddball. And one of the things that was very powerful about Young Arts was it was the first competition I did that acknowledged my original work as a cellist, because everything else I was doing, I'd done the Tchaikovsky competition, I'd done all these huge competitions as a technician. And that moment was huge for me, because it was the moment that I suddenly thought to myself, wow, the cello can be an instrument outside classical music. It can have a voice in jazz. And their believing in me has led me on to have a career performing with, I don't know, everyone from like Paul Simon to Frank Ocean to James Taylor to Tony Bennett, because I started to believe that cello didn't have to just be a symphony instrument, which has been pretty fun.
So. Is it fair to say you were a prodigy?
I started
playing at three?
Yeah, I started performing very young, and, you know, I did have a whole child part of my career. But one of the reasons that Young Arts was so powerful for me was because, you know, and I think Caleb just said it so eloquently, you're at this transition point where you've learned a classical art form. You're technically very good, but you really don't know what to do with it in the adult world. You don't know how to tell your own stories. You've been taught a lot of other people's stories, and you've been taught how to win things. And I think it was very powerful to be able to have had that already that whole career, but then come to a place where people were challenging me more creatively and narratively and less just like, did you nail the high note or not?
I wonder too, I mean, because what, by that point you'd already performed at Carnegie and on Broadway, right?
Yeah.
All right, I'm curious if that doesn't put you in a position where, yes, you're going to, every experience is going to be good for you. It opens your eyes to something else, but having the experience you've already had walking in that, You also weren't helping some of your peers. I mean, you already had experiences they haven't had yet.
But one of the most beautiful things was also, however, you know, having had that kind of trajectory that I had, but then I also met in Young Arts Week a writer from Alaska, and she'd never been at anything like that. And it was so inspiring to, which is, I think, one of the reasons that led me to be fascinated with working with singer-songwriters and things like that, to realize that, you know, wherever you come from, that's your story. And that's what's artistic about it. And it's learning how to merge your craft with that story that makes you into a great artist. And Young Arts, it had people that had had Juilliard training like me, and it had people that had none of that. And putting us together and making us collaborate, I think, was a very powerful thing, because up to that point, I'd really only worked with people who had training just like me, which was great, but didn't really put me outside my comfort zone in the same way.
I want to know about what you're going to be doing, the performances that you're going to be creating with students this week. But let me start with this, Caleb. You come in and you get to talk to these young people, and I'm thinking about what you learned in your experience in 2011. What are you bringing? What do you want to tell these young people?
Oh, it's a great privilege to be in the position I'm in, because you get to work with the most talented group of high schoolers that you'll probably ever meet. And anything that you get to impart on their path, their journey, their career.
Is there anything that you wish somebody had told you, but now you get the chance to tell?
I get to tell them that, you know, ego is a good thing and ego is a bad thing, and you are the most talented person from your hometown, but guess what? All these people are the most talented people from their hometown, and no one is going to threaten your career by being exceptionally talented. In fact, you know, there's company at the top, as it were.
All right, so wait a minute. So I'm hearing you say that. Is that something you were dealing with?
No, I was from a small town in New York. I didn't really have an ego yet, but any kind of ego I thought I had, I was humbled immediately by these incredibly talented people. That, you know, this is also a time before Instagram and Twitter and YouTube even. You know, I didn't know any of these people existed, and suddenly I was aware of this incredible group, and, you know, It was humbling, but in the best way.
What are you going to be working with the students on this week?
I'm directing the mixed discipline performance, meaning I'm working with 7 dancers, 7 theater artists, and 7 vocalists, all of different disciplines within those disciplines, actually. So I have classical singers, and I have singer-songwriters, and I have pop vocalists, I have tap dancers, I have contemporary dancers, and we're making a new collaborative work that allows each participant to showcase their best of what they know so well. And then my job also is to allow them to step outside their comfort zone and recognize that at 16, 17, there's still so much to learn, and you learn even more when you get to collaborate with someone else.
All right. Dave, I got to ask you about the egos. Dealing with egos.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm curious, like, you know, what are you going to try to share with young people this week?
One of the things that I'm going to be working on a lot with is sort of how to respond on your feet immediately to situations. I feel like I came out of Juilliard as a classical artist, but I was immediately thrown into the hip hop world. And you're not going to get a piece of music paper put in front of you. You're not going to be playing a symphony. You're going to have artists that you're going to have to come up with ideas immediately, think on your feet. And so one of the things we decided to do that's really fun is we're sort of reimagining a lot of their classical repertoire. And I decided, instead of bringing in a sort of more traditional faculty, we have a composer who's a tap dancer. We have a composer who's a producer and beats a maker and percussionist. And we have a guest artist who's a storyteller who's going to work with classical musicians on narrative in their work. But to really kind of empower the students in a way to realize that, you know, it is very much a do-it-yourself world now. You really do have to build your own thing as an artist, and how to seize the tradition you come from, but also make it contemporarily relevant. And so the program itself, we're going to be kind of looking at taking pieces by Chopin and Schumann and contemporizing them for sort of today's audience a little bit and having some fun with that.
Yeah. When it comes to, you know, bringing different genres and styles, I mean, you know, from your own personal experience, what are some of the things? Yeah, I know you just touched on some of it, but I'm curious, like, what you're bringing from your own repertoire and your own background and experience, what is it you want to instill in these young people?
A sense that, like, no matter what genre you're working in, you're always telling a story, and that story always has relevance. I think a lot about creating characters when I play with different bands, and like who I am with, like I just finished a 3-month tour with the band Evanescence. Who I am in Evanescence is very different from who I am with Philip Phillips, which is very different from who I am with, I'm coming up on doing a tour with Foreigner that's going to be here actually in Miami next month.
Foreigner.
So like, you know,
wow,
but
going
as
back.
You, yeah, I know. So as you like build who you are in these different things, you know, you don't look down on them. You embrace the character that you're growing into, and how can you be, you know, maybe it's not about intellectuality. Maybe it's about being more vivid as a character. Maybe it's about being more down home. Maybe it's about being more country. Like, enjoy those kind of things. So we're going to be working a lot on style points and kind of, you know, the things that are really going to be relevant as they go out and have to work it. Right now, if you're going to be a classical string player, you have to be able to play every genre. It's not just one thing anymore.
So. Again, I'm talking with Dave Egger. He is a composer, cellist, and pianist, and Caleb Teicher. He is a dancer and choreographer. And of course, what they both have in common is they both have won the Young Arts Award, and they're going to be here as alumni, passing that wisdom on to the next generation. And that is going on this week, by the way. It started actually today, and it goes through the 25th. It's at the Miami Theater Center. Caleb, you co-founded a dance company the same year you won Young Arts, right?
Yeah, I've been choreographing since I was a teenager. I've known it's always been my greatest interest to make work as well as perform work. And now that's kind of what I do full time. I travel to Europe, and I travel to Canada, and I travel across the United States with a mixed discipline dance company, meaning we do tap dance, swing dance, and vernacular jazz dance. And we make new work, and we travel to theaters, and we spread the gospel of American dance.
Are you, by the way, with the performances that you're doing with the students, are you recording this stuff? Is this stuff that's going to be out there for people to be able to, you know, to consume?
I don't know.
I think Young Arts makes an archival record of it, but I believe actually, if you want to see the show, you got to be there.
You got to come see the show.
All right, that's always the plus. Come see the show, but yeah. I mean, in the world that we live in today, because you said it, Caleb, it's like, you know, we have Instagram, Facebook, giving more people who don't have the ability to make it to the show the chance to see the show.
Young Arts actually has a fantastic Instagram account. I love following it. And you'll probably, if you follow Young Arts on Instagram throughout the week, you'll see great updates of probably behind the scenes stuff from us in rehearsals for these performances.
Yep.
By the way, Dave, you're in a contemporary string quartet?
Yes, I've been in quite a lot of them, but yes, I was in a group called Flux for many years. Contemporary string quartet.
Oh, you were? Are you still?
Yeah, I'm not right now because I'm touring other things. But I was in a group called Flux for many years, which was sort of well known for its 6-hour performance of Morton Feldman's famous second string quartet.
I wanted to come back to something that you guys had talked about when you're talking to these this next generation of performers. Is getting them the advice, helping them and understand what to do next. Because look, I mean, all of us, whether we're artists or not, You know, you get to that certain age and you're like, well, what do I want to do next? And if you think you know what you want to study next, the question comes up, well, what am I going to do with this? You know, and of course, trying to find an answer is always challenging.
It's also like very complex in the arts, because unfortunately for the way the arts are in America, there's a time clock on it too, especially in music and acting and dance as well, where like if you don't do it when you're young, it's very hard to get your foot in the door. So a lot of times as a teacher, that's very hard, because if you're working with a talented 17-year-old songwriter, I'm in that industry and I know that after 21, labels aren't really looking at people. So it's very hard. Like you may be like, it might be great for you to go to college and have that experience, but it may be smarter. Like I have a good friend that I'm working with who's in that position. And like, he just went to LA because it was smarter to kind of get it going. And
so sometimes you have to tell these people, skip school. You got to go do this
absolutely,
now.
Absolutely. Because it depends. What to do next is entirely dependent on the individual. It's very like for some people, a reality show is the answer. There are people that I've known where I'm like, I used to work for American Idol with Phil Phillips, is like, go do Idol because you're the kind of person that will help. And there's another kind of artist that I'm like, get in a Volvo and start playing little, you know, drive around the country and sell your own CDs. It's very different for each person. But I think one of the things that's so beautiful about Young Arts is bringing artists like Caleb and hopefully myself in conjunction with these young people who were active working professionals who know all these real world challenges. And I think, you know, these kids are really hungry for that, and they don't necessarily get that in their conservatory programs. They get other things, but they don't get that real world angle so much.
I agree. The arts is a very tricky subject to be in a leading position, and because the only thing you can do is say, this was my experience, this is how I went through my life, and you may have the exact opposite experience, you may have a similar experience, but the best I can do is try to guide you and help you sift through all the things that you'll be told through your life as an artist, whether you should audition for this, you shouldn't audition for this, you should lock yourself into a cabin for a month and just practice. We are going to do our best to try to recognize what is unique, what is special, and what is specific about each person's craft, and say, here's where we think you might fit in this great world of the arts.
And how often, by the way, when you're talking to students, you have to, you kind of have to be real with them. I mean, look, these are talented young people already. So they haven't gotten to this point without showing that they've got something. But at the same time, look, you guys have been out there. You know that you can look at somebody and say, this you could do, maybe not this. Let's be realistic. It's that ego thing, right?
I think you have to be really careful with that, though. I'm so sorry.
You got this fired up.
You have to be really careful with that, because you have to see what the person wants, how much they want it. I'm thinking of a singer right now that I worked with that, it's funny, like 5 years ago, she came to have me produce some songs for her in New York, and I introduced her to a friend of mine. She wanted to do Broadway. I introduced her to a friend of mine who wrote a huge Broadway musical, and that friend told her that she should give up. Well, 4 years down the road, she ended up starring in that same musical in her regional theater production, and the reviewer wrote that she was better than the woman on Broadway. Now she's on a national equity tour. She doesn't look quite, you know, the way you'd imagine for Broadway, but she just nailed it. And I think the thing is, you just have to see drive, you have to see personality, you have to see technique, and then you can help advise people in the details of, like, you know, like Caleb said, like, what did you do? Like, I can just say, well, here's what I did. Here's my workaround. Here's what I did when I was up against the similar barrier. I did this. So, sorry, I'll head into
No, it's okay. Also, a lot of these kids are already very real with themselves. They see the world. They know how many talented people are out there. Sometimes, actually, the best thing we can do is just tell them to dream again and to expand their horizons. These 17-year-olds are so refined sometimes. They say, I know exactly what I do well. I sing these works by Schumann beautifully. Or, you know, I play this, or I dance this, but I only dance this. And part of what's great about Young Arts and being exposed to people from other disciplines is you challenge yourself in the week. You step outside of your own comfort zone and say, well, I'm 17. I shouldn't be closing myself off to the rest of the world yet.
Yeah. And also, I would say a big thing for me is just sharing what a different direction my career went from when I was 17. You know, say, like, you can be, I was so sure I was going to play nothing but classical contemporary music. Now I play bluegrass, hip hop. Like, when you told me that. And so, like, be open. Like, one of the best advice that I ever got about my career was a friend of mine said to me, she said, wow, you're such a great improviser with music. It's terrible. You're such a terrible improviser in your career. So I think this idea of, like, how do you improvise in your career is very powerful.
And he also worked on American American Idol. So there you go. Again, Dave Egger, he's a composer, cellist, pianist, Caleb Teicher, dancer and choreographer. And again, both of them Young Arts winners, and they're going to be working with the new Young Arts talent. Again, that Young Arts Miami is going on today through the 25th at the Miami Theater Center. We'll have more information on our website. Gentlemen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
All right, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you on Thursday.